You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And I'm Eric Clay, the host, and our guest on this hour is Blake Hendrickson. Blake, it's good to have you here this morning.
It's great to be here. I'm excited.
Good, good. So Blake, the way the show starts is, you know, you just give me kind of an overview of an answer to the question, who are you? And that can be qualities, labels, whatever you want, but it lets us start the process of getting to know one another on the air.
I think that's a difficult question because who I am, usually I do like maybe a linear sort of chronological order of my life. Whereas if you asked my mother or my father or my sisters, they might say something different. Or my girlfriend might say something
this
else.
This is your subjective starting point where you want to start the
conversation. So my mother might think, you know, might describe me as some little blonde-haired kid running around, usually pretty happy guy.
Kind of where you came into her life.
Right, kind of happy guy, didn't really cause me much problems, never got into too much trouble, and they were always really proud.
Uh-huh.
I guess that's kind of how my mother would see me. I mention her because I know that whenever I've been on the radio, your parents are the ones that are always listening. So,
yes.
Give a shout out to the parents because they're likely the ones that are listening on a Sunday morning. I guess my chronological idea of who I am, I grew up in Minnesota. I'm a guy from Minnesota. Mm-hmm. I lived there for about 22 years of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And then I moved on. I decided that Minnesota, although it gave me a really good background and footing in life, I felt like I needed some more diversity. And to kind of spread my wings a little bit after university, so I moved to Europe and spent a couple of years there. Trying to, I don't know, didn't really know what else to do. It seemed to make sense.
Right.
And I guess I've always kind of been a guy sort of living for a year or two in a place and then moving on.
Right.
The last place I was in Argentina for 5.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of hard to move on after that long of a time. And now I'm here in Ithaca.
Right. And so what have you been doing in these places? What's your passion? What have you been active doing?
I guess a combination of teaching and studying mostly.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I think growing up at going to university, I was like, wow, it's really cool. This whole student thing, studying.
Student
I really
gig.
Liked the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And I realized one way to do that for your whole life is to become a professor.
Right.
Seemed like that's the guys that I met there. My professors seemed to be really, really happy guys or girls or whatever.
Right, right.
So that's kind of, I guess, what I've been doing in other countries. It's been teaching English.
Mm-hmm.
In the U.S., mostly teaching communication.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I guess a combination of both.
Right, right, right. And that is not an uncommon path to Ithaca. And I think you're one of maybe 4 or 5 Minnesotans I can remember who've been on the show after
really?
250 guests. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's, I mean, we get a lot of people coming into Ithaca from lots of different places.
Well, I mean, Minnesota isn't like a high population area. There's probably about 4 or 5 million people in the state. So
yeah.
I guess we get out.
Yeah. And I'm from Missouri, so I'm
okay.
Two states down. So,
uh-huh.
People
often confuse Minnesota, Missouri, state that starts with an M.
Right, right. Yeah. And they don't know how to abbreviate it.
Right.
Anyway,
it's true.
So you brought some music with you.
Right.
And we're going to start with The Roots, The Seed. And do you want to say anything about that before we play it?
Well, oftentimes, you know, you might be at a party or a gathering and the music is just kind of, you know, nobody's really taking control or doing anything. And sometimes somebody says, put something on. You choose something.
Right.
And I'm not really a DJ. I like listening to music, but whenever I need to play a song to get the party going,
right,
I guess this is my go-to song.
This is
and I only have one, so.
Okay. And was this a go-to song in Argentina too?
I always played this song.
Oh, cool.
Usually like, everybody's ready. We got our coats on. Maybe we're going to take one last shot before we go out and we'll put this song on.
Okay. Well, here we go.
So, cause hip hop is old, she don't want no rock and roll. She want out of summer fall. If you were obstacles, you just drive you cold. Cause one month you don't stop the show. Little Mary's bad. In these streets she done ran ever since when the heat began. I told a girl, look here, calm down, I'ma hold your hand to enable you to peep the plan. Cause you was quick to learn, and we can make money to burn. If you allow me to lay this game, I don't ask for much, but enough room to spread my way. And the world finna know my name.
I don't ask
listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Blake Hendrickson. So, Blake, what brought you to Ithaca? How did you, you know, your wanderings from Minnesota, around the world, Argentina, and what brought you here to Ithaca?
So I suppose when I was finishing up my PhD down in Argentina, I started to look for, I guess, academic jobs mm-hmm. in the U.S., it's not that I was doing bad in Argentina or that life was, you know, I needed to get out. I yeah. was and really struggling with wanting.
What did you study?
I specifically studied communication.
Uh-huh,
and
uh-huh.
Argentina was a more general degree, which is a PhD in social sciences.
I see.
So I had colleagues that studied many different things, ranging from geography to education to political science to tourism management.
Almost the communication of meaning on any level.
Right, yes. And they came from many different countries throughout Latin America. So it was a mix of several of different crazy things. I mean, I was the one that was specifically studying intercultural communication is what uh-huh. I study. And so I wanted to, I think I kind of felt like I owed it to my parents a little bit to get closer.
Right.
They felt like I'd been really far away for a really long time, and I wanted to get a shot at the academic world.
Right.
So, an opportunity came up here in Ithaca at Ithaca College. So I decided make the move, see how it goes. I had a really good, really close friend, colleague, mentor. Previous professor, mm-hmm. co-author, all kinds of different things put together.
A person whose life's intertwined with yours yes. in many ways.
Yes, and crazy enough, I understand that he's going to be the guest after me today. So I'm sort of like warming up the radio listeners for Devin. So hopefully everybody sticks around and listens to him as well. So that's kind of what brought me here. Uh-huh. A position came up at Ithaca College.
Okay, and what is that position?
It's in the Roy H. Park School of Communications,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
in the TVR program, television radio program.
Uh-huh.
And I specifically teach mass media research methods. I teach uh-huh. research methods course. I teach a statistics course for strategic communication. And I teach a media law and policy class that has an international kind of context.
Yeah. So how do the rules around, I mean, just for the
right,
Bible
that's
or
one of my
play
exactly.
in different parts of the world.
That's part of the reason I asked you the question about the copyright issues with community radio.
Sure,
and I
sure.
imagine that they're different than other programs and
right.
situations.
Yes, yes, yes.
And so,
yes.
So I like to do research and teach research.
Okay. So what are some of the experiences that have shaped who you are? Was there a big one, or were there a bunch of little ones that added up along the way? How did you kind of come to be the person you are?
Well, I because I can't maybe I'd have to sit down with a psychologist probably to
well
to
no this
pull
is
out,
this
well,
is
maybe,
your gut reaction
maybe to
your
pull
best
out some go back to some in Argentina they do a lot of Lacan and psychiatric sort of go back to your childhood kind
Argentina,
of stuff.
I believe, is said to be the most psychoanalyzed country in the world.
Right. Per capita, they have the most. Yes, exactly. So without doing that, I would likely have to say it has something to do with when I was an undergraduate, I had a professor that told stories about when he was studying abroad in France.
Mm-hmm.
And he used all these stories to teach the concepts
sure.
that we're learning in interpersonal communication. And he told the one story about being in France and meeting a girl and hooking up. He didn't really go into the details of exactly what they had done.
A little suggestive.
Right,
yeah.
They had spent some intimate time together. And the next day he ran into her in the street, in the plaza. And he was with a friend. And when he introduced his friend to this girl that he just met or that he had been with the night before, mm-hmm. he introduced her as his friend.
Mm-hmm.
This is my friend, we'll call her, I don't know, Amandine, and this yeah. is my friend Roy, I don't know.
Yeah.
And then nothing happened. Later that afternoon, he went to her house or whatever, and when she opened the door, she gave him a huge slap in the face. It was just whack! And he told his story in class, and I was wow, I want that. And he explained the reason why is that in France, they don't have the same sort of rules or definitions for what a relationship is. He should have introduced her as his girlfriend because they had been together intimately. And you can have right. several of these people that are your.
Right.
Maybe in the U.S., it's you don't call someone your girlfriend.
You wouldn't have multiple girlfriends.
You
wouldn't advertise it.
You wouldn't define multiple people as your girlfriend.
Right. That's, yeah. okay. Yes, you have phrased it exactly
so,
right.
So then I ended up spending a summer term,
uh-huh.
and I ended up going through this same program, the same town in France, Aix-en-Provence. I was there for 6 weeks, and I think this experience, I had never studied a language before really, mm-hmm. this experience of being able to communicate in a different way, in a different language it did something to me. I was just became curious about, and also what's the word? I don't want to say the wrong word because it's impotent. I felt, wow, all these other people in the world are speaking several languages
right.
and I'm, monolingual.
Incompetent.
Incompetent, yeah.
Culturally incompetent
yes,
or
yes,
linguistically
like
incompetent.
This. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that's, I guess, maybe that shaped me and formed me because the year after that, I ended up moving back to France to stay for a whole year
uh-huh.
to teach English. So I think that was something that started it. Yeah.
Okay. And what were you studying as an undergrad?
Communication.
Okay.
Communication.
So straight through.
Yeah, communication. And then when I was in a senior during the J term, I did another an intercultural communication class in Hawaii. And a professor taught us about intercultural communication, but through engagement with local Hawaiians.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned that was also really important for me to see how you can learn about other cultures through interaction. Right. And that was kind of like something that has stayed with me up until this day.
Right.
Kind of a teaching philosophy.
I had the fortune of being good fortune of being able to be an exchange student in Colombia, for six months of 1976, back in the dark ages.
1976 in Colombia. Where can I ask? What city?
Pereira.
Pereira,
which is halfway between Medellin and Cali.
Okay.
And just due west of Bogota.
You were like pre Pablo Escobar and everything.
What happened was they were just coming out of the shared government between the conservatives and the liberals.
Okay.
And when I arrived back in the US in July, or I think it was the 1st of August, there was a cover of Time magazine that had a marijuana leaf, because that was when things hit the fan here in the US. Colombians weren't quite yet worried about the drugs flowing through Colombia, which had been flowing through for probably 15 years at that point.
Yeah.
But they hadn't really got worried about it until just beginning about the time I was there. Some of the families were worried about kids getting addicted to various things and kind of their lives were getting messed up. So it was this period of time between civil war and between the drug war. And it was pretty nice.
Uh-huh.
It was a pretty good time to be there. But what I was going to say was, for me, the learning, I didn't realize that to learn another language or another culture, you have to physically and emotionally and intellectually kind of reinvent yourself all at once.
Right.
And what appealed to me coming out of that was, you know, because I grew up on a subsistence farm in rural poverty in northwest Missouri.
Uh-huh.
And so this was a huge step. I stayed with a family that was eons above me in economic class than where I had come from.
Right.
And I had more in common with the maids
and the
farm workers that they had hired for their coffee farm.
Uh-huh.
But they were medical people. So anyway, what surprised me was that you have to engage this as a full body sport. And I'm getting a sense that that's kind of almost how it was for you. You know, the story of the slap, the story of the kind of the coming awake kind of waked your whole person up to things and that you hadn't experienced.
You have to rely on elements of your personality that aren't related to language.
Yes.
Particularly humor. Like all of a sudden you realize, I don't have any references to make me funny anymore. You don't have any television shows. You don't have this like best friends that know you so well that when you look at each other, you laugh. It's like you rely on you and nothing else. Nothing like else that came before you. Just like you are there and everybody's
and
new.
You are going to make gestures that will have connotations that are out of your control because you're a newbie.
Right, exactly. And you might make the wrong gestures. I've done the... It's kind of hard to talk about gestures, I suppose, over the radio.
But I mean, we've actually done stranger
things. One of them is like, in Argentina, sometimes people do like this arm thing like this.
Yeah.
I'm kind of pumping my fist a little bit.
Right.
And in the U.S. it's kind of like, yeah, let's party.
It's from the center of the chest out.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I kind of get this impression that in the U.S. it's sort of like, let's party, you know? Like, let's go out, let's party, woohoo.
Or hey, dude.
Yeah. And exactly. In Argentina, it has something to do with like, you know, it's kind of like a sexual thing. It's like, you know, let's do it. But that's, you know, those kinds of things, I guess, happen.
But the thing is you have the permission, if they know that you're a newbie, and you know that you're a newbie, then you can oftentimes laugh at yourself if you catch it and if they are direct with you. And just because I've been in situations, not even then, but here back in the U.S., where there are lots of people who don't speak the same language culturally, gesture-wise, or whatever. And if you can kind of accept each other with that lightheartedness and laugh your way through it, as you said, it's a huge advantage.
So can I turn the tables and ask you a question?
Sure.
When we're talking about life, like changing experiences, and you went to Colombia, what do you think was more of a flash in your mind or a change? Changing cultures or changing class?
Oh boy, you know, you're of all the years I've told the story, you're the first person to ever ask me that question. And that, you know, I went there I went there 40 years ago.
Right.
It was both. It was both. I think the economic class differences were clunkier and more obvious in some ways to me. The cultural differences were more obvious to them.
Right.
And so we were in kind of a different world. The Colombian, the mother in the Colombian family took me aside, and she had me come home at lunch, because oftentimes kids at school don't have lunch at school. You go home and you eat. And so I came home and eat, and she basically gave me etiquette lessons because I didn't know this stuff in the U.S., let alone in Colombia.
Yeah.
And so, and she had lived in the U.S. with her husband when he was studying at the Eye Institute at Columbia.
Right.
And so she knew a lot of what I was coming from in terms of general American stuff, but not rural stuff. And but she could make the connection, which really helped me enormously.
Right.
And translate those things.
So it's important to have somebody that understands you and can help you.
In my life, the economic class issues, I'm much more sensitive to them because they are the ones that are the least speakable. We can talk more about race, we can talk more about culture, but we almost don't have a language for class differences.
Right.
And that's where a lot of my work lives.
Right.
So anyway. Yeah.
Well, that was something that I guess it's a lot from reading George Orwell.
Uh-huh.
He has some good books about like being an anthropologist, but not going to other cultures, just like within his culture, like studying class and living with the tramps of Northern England and these kinds of things.
Yeah.
And I felt similar, but the opposite, I guess, when I was in Argentina. My very first job was teaching English at an oil company named Halliburton. If you're familiar with this, they're kind of like the Axis of Evil. well, they were at the time, and I mean,
and they're one of the big technology companies behind, they do the actual drilling. Right.
And when I was there, it was when there was this oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. I had just started working there, and Halliburton was one of the three sort of like companies on the, you know, on trial, we'll say. And so my students were like the human resource manager and another guy who was like a director. And part of our English class is them just talking. And this guy was showing me like his new house that he was building with a pool and a waterfall. And he had a nice little river behind his house. And I had students that were in a completely different class than myself. And in a completely different class than I had really aspired to be in. And those kinds of things kind of makes you feel like a little bit uncomfortable. It's the opposite. It's the same if you go in the street and then hang out with other groups. But I realized there was one thing that kind of we saw at eye, me and this really rich oil guy, and maybe somebody if I, you know, maybe drop down a class, is that at the end of the day, he wanted the same thing for his children that I think I would want for my children, which was he wants his children to basically give them everything that all the opportunities that he's had and maybe a little bit more. So I think his love for his children made me like get past all of this class thing and realize that humans aren't maybe that different.
Right.
But you have to really sort through a lot of stuff to get to that, I guess, specific, I guess, love for children and families across, you know.
Yeah, and I think when you've got that sense of investment, that kind of draws us, I would say, back to middle class values. There's among the very affluent, there's a kind of carelessness that is very similar to the very poor. But the poor can't care, because if they cared, they would be too devastated by not being able to act on what they care about. And the very affluent don't have to care, because whatever they do, they can do something else because they have the resources. And so in some sense, we don't oftentimes see those two as being very similar.
Right.
And they are in kind of a relational sort of way. And what you described is kind of the middle class common ground about caring about our children for the future and how we can project them out as kind of a power statement about who we are. And there's a little bit of privilege there, but it's not huge.
Right.
If you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. Definitely.
So cool. So let's cut to music again. What would you like to play next?
Well, so I like this song. I think it's a good time to listen to it. It's called Manu Chao. It's Me Gustas Tú.
Yeah.
It's in Spanish, so if there's some bad words, it's probably okay. I found that playing radio in another country. I don't think there's too many bad words, but it's basically everything that Manu Chao says that he likes or me gusta. I feel like, hey, I like that too.
Right. Here we go.
Qué horas son, mi corazón. Te lo dije bien clarito.
Permanece a la escucha. noche en La Habana, Cuba.
11 de la noche en San Salvador, El Salvador.
11 de la noche en Managua, Nicaragua.
Me gustan los aviones, me gustas tú. Me gusta viajar, me gustas tú. Me gusta la mañana, me gustas tú. Me gusta el viento, me gustas tú. Me gusta soñar, me gustas tú. Me gusta la mar, me gustas tú. ¿Qué voy a hacer? Je ne sais pas. ¿Qué voy a hacer? Je ne sais plus. ¿Qué voy a hacer? Je suis perdu. ¿Qué horas son, mi corazón? Me gusta la moto, me gustas tú. Me gusta correr, me gustas tú. Me gusta la lluvia, me gustas tú. Me gusta volver, me gustas tú. Me gusta marihuana, me gustas tú. Me gusta colombiana, me gustas tú. Me gusta la montaña, me gustas tú. Me gusta la noche. ¿Qué voy a hacer? Je ne sais pas. ¿Qué voy a hacer? Je ne sais plus. ¿Qué voy a hacer? Je suis perdu. Me gusta su cocina, me gustas
de la
tú.
Mañana.
Me gusta camelar, me gustas tú. Me gusta la guitarra, me gustas tú. Me gusta el reggae, me gustas tú. ¿Qué voy a hacer? Je ne sais pas. ¿Qué voy a hacer? Je ne sais plus. ¿Qué voy a hacer? Je suis perdu. ¿Qué horas son, mi corazón? Me gusta la canela, me gustas tú. Me gusta el fuego, me gustas tú. Me gusta menear, me gustas tú. Me gusta La Coruña, me gustas tú. Me gusta Malasaña, me gustas tú. Me gusta la castaña, me gustas tú. Me gusta Guatemala, me gustas tú. ¿Qué voy a hacer? Je ne sais pas. ¿Qué voy a hacer? Je ne sais plus. ¿Qué voy a hacer? Je suis perdu. ¿Qué horas son, mi corazón?
Listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Blake Hendrickson. So, Blake, one of the things that's kind of an interesting, quirky thing about Tompkins County and Ithaca is that we're less diverse than the state of Kansas. In the state of Kansas, you've got just under 80% white. Non-Hispanics. You've got 5% Latinos, 5% African Americans, 5% Native Americans, and 5% Asian. We don't have hardly any Native Americans here, and so the Asian population is about 10%. So in that arguable way, we are less diverse. However, we have a lot of people whose native languages are not English.
Right.
And we also have what may be the most religiously diverse small county in the U.S., or at least in upstate New York, for sure, because we are a Christian minority. We are 40-45% Christian, 40-45% non-religious folks, atheists. And then we have a large Jewish population, mostly secular, and mm-hmm. a significant Buddhist practicing population, Hindu and yoga practicing,
right.
and Muslim, minor, but still about close to 1%, depending upon how you mm-hmm. count. So we have a lot of different things here. But we perceive ourselves as wanting diversity in some sense more than we actually have it.
Right.
What is the? I want to ask you about, you know, why does intercultural communication matter, and how do you see it mattering here as a newcomer or not? Because you've just been here for less than what, 6-8 months?
Yeah, 6 months.
Yeah,
we'll say.
So as a newcomer, you know, this is your thing. So right. What is intercultural communication, and how do you see it mattering here?
Well, those like numbers, I guess, the outside surprised me
uh-huh.
because I mean, the first thing you notice when you arrive in Ithaca, it's wow, there's an Egyptian restaurant, there's a Thai restaurant, there's another Thai restaurant, there's a French restaurant, there's a Chinese restaurant, in terms of like ethnic restaurants, I feel like I've seen more here than I saw in Buenos Aires.
Right.
And it's a city of 3-4 million people. So I don't know.
So you're seeing our cultural aspirations more than our reality.
Or people that are really interested in eating and like food. Good food. Yeah. I'm not sure.
That interest in food, you know, it was very different. I've been here for most of the last 40 years. So it was very different. And in the last 20 years, we've had this explosion of ethnic restaurants.
I think that's also, a reflection. If you're willing to or interested in eating, mm-hmm. and that there's a demand for a restaurant that's from like a more ethnically distant place. I think it shows an openness mm-hmm. of a population, at mm-hmm. least that there's a demand for that. I mean, that was the thing that surprised me more than anything, uh-huh. I think, when I first got here.
So visually, it presented as a welcoming, diverse place.
Yeah, at least like a place that, there's definitely people living in Ithaca that have an urging or desire to learn more about other cultures mm-hmm. and other places. Yeah. You might on the outside think like, just food is nothing. But I think food is a really important aspect of culture. Okay, that sounds really like, that's obvious. But
well, I mean, there's a saying, you know, that keeping kosher didn't, you know, the Jews don't keep kosher. Kosher keeps people Jewish.
Right.
As the food keeps the identity.
Right.
And yeah.
Well, we had in Argentina, we had a class that was called the Culture of Food and Wine. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And people were like, this is just a class on eating and drinking wine. but it's not that. It was like the class was helping students understand about the importance of how the food is related to the economy, how the food is related to even to people's existence. Mm-hmm. And we talked a lot about, we had a class on how the food is a representation of who we are as a culture and like there are different varieties. And well, I didn't teach that class. I just did a specific, like, I interviewed the teacher on the radio program.
Sure,
So
in Spanish.
Well, no, we actually, in Argentina, we had an English radio program.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah.
And the idea was to spread, like, it was similar to this. We had lots of guests come in and we'd, you know, choose a specific topic that usually they were experts on something. But sure. That's a different story. So the question was, why is, for me, intercultural communication important? So we could think about, I guess, different areas. If we were to think about maybe business, which mm-hmm. is something that usually sells, you know. I think in order to be successful in any kind of like company or any kind of, I guess, environment now where you have, well, basically, unless you're like my father who has a small business in his small town and he doesn't have many clients outside of there, you have to deal with people from other countries, from other cultures. And what intercultural communication does is it gives you, it gives you like a framework to understand where cultural differences comes from. I think that's sort of kind of superficial in a way, that framework.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
In order to really learn about intercultural communication, in my opinion, you have to have like guided interactions with people from other cultures and not just like sit down and have a coffee. It's like sit students down or in a workshop or a training session and have them give them like specific things that you think it's important for them to talk about. And mm-hmm. by talking about that, like certain issues come up that it's like kind of happens organically. These like conversations. And through doing that, you can put yourself in easier, have more empathy for that person and put yourself maybe into their shoes. Mm-hmm. So you can maybe better understand, I guess, what they want. So do you have I learned this in philosophy class, the actual terms, but you have the golden rule, which mm-hmm. is treat others how you want to be treated.
Right.
But in an intercultural situation, that doesn't do much good because if I treat somebody from Japan who I would want to be treated, I'm probably going to make a mistake and offend them. I'm right. not going to be treating them the right way.
Right. And the moral dilemma of the golden rule is that it's self-referential.
Right.
And it's and for that reason, it does not work, even though we often appeal to it.
Yes. Yeah. Treat others how you'd want to be treated. So I think it's, correct me if I'm wrong, it's sure. the platinum rule, which is treat others how they want to be treated.
Yeah,
and that's not so easy, because then you have to figure out how they want to be treated.
Right, right.
So what intercultural communication does is, it's obviously not going to tell you how everybody wants to be treated, but it'll give you some kind of framework to try and understand, like, okay, what could I do differently, or how should I communicate so I could potentially reach the situation where I'm treating this person how they want to be treated.
Sure.
And so maybe that, I guess, is what intercultural communication does, is it reaches this platinum rule in a way.
Uh-huh. And so, no, and what I have found in my own work with communication across cultural or religious difference is, you know, somebody will say, well, I'm a Christian. Okay, so what sort of a Christian are you? You know, what are your community references?
Right.
What's your historical references? Is it a flat hierarchy? Are you part of a really steep hierarchical
right.
organization? How do you see, how does your personal experience weigh with respect to the text or with respect to the institution? And people start telling their stories in all sorts of funny sorts of ways.
Right.
Or with a Colombian, what sort of a Colombian are you? You know, where did your family come from? Oh, my father stood on the top of his building when the mudslide wiped out a whole village in 1978, I think it was, or 80. And because he'd built his out of reinforced concrete, it
right.
didn't fall, but all the other buildings the town got completely buried, except
uh-huh.
for my grandfather's. But anyway, so you find yeah. these stories about people and you learn things about their character.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, and I think it's also, it helps you, I think, by having this, like, teaching and learning and understanding out there, it's essentially teaches, like, understanding and understanding the other. And in theory, the idea is kind of reduce prejudice and not basing our immediate, like, perceptions on stereotypes.
Uh-huh.
So instead of, like, making decisions about a person based on a stereotype, we make a decision about a person based on about who that person is.
Right.
Not necessarily the culture that is assigned to them or their religion or these kinds of things.
Right. So. But yeah. And yet we have to use all of those structures to kind of begin to figure out
right.
where
does this
person stand.
That's the problem with stereotypes. Is not a problem with stereotypes, but there's a stereotype for a reason. And, like, there's lots of stereotypes about U.S. Americans.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I can give a list. It's probably the list of stereotypes I know the best.
Right.
And I kind of, in a way, some of those stereotypes apply to me.
Right.
There's some truth behind that. But right. the thing is that it's like the degree of how strong that stereotype is within each person is what changes.
Right.
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 The degree which it appears.
Right. Yeah. Right. A stereotype is like a sloppy tool.
Mm, yeah.
You know,
I like
it's
that.
Like an axe. You can make a nice rough cut with it, but you can't make a precise
right.
chisel mark.
That's a really good metaphor.
You don't. And you can't give up your stereotypes. Mm-hmm. I mean, for example, I was at a training event where we were asked to look at this person and say, what's their cultural background? And because of my background in physical anthropology, I said, well, they could be from Finland. They could be from Italy. They could be an Asian, Eurasian, Euro-American cross. You know, because there are certain features that come from all those different parts of the globe that would add up to that kind of a look. And they were saying, like, how did you know that? Because
right.
they expected everybody to just throw one simple stereotype
yeah.
at that person. And but when we want to use the stereotypes, we just don't want to be locked up in them.
Right. Do you mind if I use that metaphor?
Sure.
And I'll quote you. I'll give you. It's like a sloppy tool. I like that.
So anyhow, I guess, you know, let's cut to music because I want to get in a couple of more of your songs
okay.
before we call it a time. What should we play next?
Let's see. How about we play? Let's go with because the place where I guess I learned about intercultural communication, and
sure.
it kind of goes with the theme,
uh-huh.
was originally in Hawaii.
Okay.
And then later in life, I got a chance to live there for 2 years. And this was, I guess, a theme song for our life. When I say our, I mean my friends and everybody that we were with.
Your cohort.
My cohort. Yeah. Yes.
Your compas.
Yes. Mis compas.
Yes. Okay. Is this Ziggy?
On the beach in Hawaii, hey, I wish you were here with me, walking on the beach in Hawaii, playing on the golden sand, looking at the ocean, now I understand. Love is like the open sea, and I wish you were here with me. On the beach in Hawaii, you've been gone away, I think about you every day. Don't you know I miss you much, and you know I need your touch. I'm on a rocky cliff, oh I wish you were here with me.
listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Blake Hendrickson. So, Blake, I'd like for you to just take a little time to sit with this question. Because you are doing intercultural communication, and because you are, you know, working across differences in some pretty intentional ways, what have you had to learn that you would not have thought you would have needed to learn? How have you been forced to change or be differently in the world than you really thought maybe you could or thought you'd ever want to? Or is that a non... I mean, are you so generally curious that that's just a non-question?
How? So the question is, how have I...
How have you had to change?
How have I changed? I think one thing that... that is definitely, like, I feel like I've changed since maybe an undergraduate.
Uh-huh.
Is I think that as an undergraduate, I had very, or even after like living in France for a year, I remember coming back from France, and I'd been there for maybe 8 months, and I was at a Billy's Bar. It's a, you know, kind of a small bar in a small town in Vergès. There's like 300 people in this town. And I was with my friends, and kind of started getting into this conversation with the local guy there, kind of what would be the, I don't know if it's politically, kind of redneck, a little bit hillbilly, you know, doesn't really get out of the small town much. I don't want to use those terms because even that's offensive. But
well, but also, you know, that's my stock. When I arrived at Cornell, I kind of talked like this in 1976. I had to get rid of my backcountry accent because it wasn't acceptable here. They didn't think I had a brain.
Well, that was thank you for making it acceptable for me to use that term.
Those are my roots, and I don't take it as offense.
Right. So this was the got into a conversation with this guy, and it was more like almost became a shouting match because he said something like. All the because this was not too far after the U.S. had invaded Iraq and we were in that situation, mm-hmm. like maybe 2005. He said all the Iraqis are terrorists, and he had kind of like this spiel,
right,
of that he's had been saying many times over and over again to many different people, and I had come back from France where basically everybody there. When I say everybody, I mean like kind of all my the other teachers that were there, we basically thought the same way. We had this idea about maybe a world where, you know, war isn't good. Being Republican isn't necessarily the best ideology or the best political party. And basically, we all thought the same way. So I never had to make any arguments. In a way, had to defend my case or my position, really ever.
You could wander within the hegemony of that thinking.
Yes. And that's dangerous because I came to this bar and I would say that this guy definitely, like, if it were a debate, he won. Like, I was just this kind of blumbering, you know, didn't have any, like, coherent, like, arguments because I never had to make an argument because you say something, everyone's like, yeah, they believe you, whatever.
Right.
So I was... In a way, at that time in my life, I think I was very maybe fundamental in many different things.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew or I felt that I was right and that the other people like needed a change and they were wrong.
Right.
And I think that after maybe 10 years later, about 10 years later, I wouldn't even... consider getting into that conversation with that guy or even think he was a bad guy for thinking what he thinks.
Right. Right.
Maybe I would, you know, it's more tolerant, I think, of different political views, more tolerant of different religious views, more tolerant of basically everything.
Right.
Even more tolerant. I think I read an awesome book from Paulo Coelho about prostitution.
Right.
Like, I guess what I say is like I've become less fundamental in any thinking and just open to like maybe it's dangerous too. Like kind of got to maybe draw the line somewhere. Right. But I basically got to a situation now where I was like, well, kind of that's, you know, whatever works for you sort of thing.
Right,
so.
Right. And I guess I see and I'm going to jump in here just a second.
Mm-hmm.
And this is. From what you said before, I don't think tolerant is the right word. What you said before was you need to understand the person as they are, which means you are open to them, their language, what it means, and their values. You're also open to their pain and their icons, their images, their symbols, their idols even. And when somebody comes at you and says, every Iraqi is a terrorist, there's pain back there. There's fear. And
right.
So where I would go with the conversation at this point in my life is, what are you afraid of?
Right.
What is at risk here that we can't let go? Because if we can talk about that good thing, we may find that there are other ways to approach it than scorching the earth for all of these people.
Yeah.
And I think that's more the spirit of what you're saying. And tolerant has this notion that I'll put my fingers on my nose and I'll have you in my presence, but I'm tolerating you. And teaching tolerance, while it has some rhetorical appeal, it's not enough.
Uh-huh.
It's like the difference between the golden rule and the platinum rule that you just outlined for us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really, really, really important.
Yeah.
And so when you say, I think I'm kind of going to let anything go, the way I hear that is that you're open to anybody kind of showing you what they value, you're not necessarily going to buy it.
Right. Yes. I mean, you're right. I haven't become just like this, you know, everything goes, it doesn't matter. Yeah. But I definitely like have gotten past my, you know, first like, oh, wow, you said that, you believe that, you're wrong.
End of conversation.
Right. I've kind of developed new, changed into an idea where the reason you think that way is because of something. There's some experiences of your life, some you've learned, you've obviously had different like past than I have that have formed that.
Right.
So and I know that I'm not going to change you necessarily. So,
but I can understand you and you may understand me.
Right.
But that's not inevitable. There has to be mutual curiosity for that to happen.
Yeah. So I guess that's probably one thing where I didn't think that I would become that. Like oftentimes when we talk about tolerance, it's like being tolerant towards another race or being tolerance towards kind of like the negative or the, when I originally thought about tolerance, I didn't think it would be the opposite. Like I'd have to learn how to be tolerant towards like the different politics or.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah. And so.
Yeah. I think anything that hits us as slightly wrong forces a second thought.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so how am I going to approach this? Am I going to get defensive or am I going to get curious?
Mm-hmm.
And if I get defensive, we're going to be in a pissing match pretty fast.
Right.
And if I get curious, there's a chance that I may learn something and I may still have my reservations, but at least I've bought some time to sort it out. Those are, you know, historically what would have been driven under the rubric of manners.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of interaction.
Right.
And yet we have poo-pooed manners because we tend to try to make them so rigid so that each person speaks one at a time and everybody gets listened to. But in a real culture, people interrupt each other.
Mm-hmm.
They talk over each other, but they take each other seriously in a way that they feel it.
Yeah.
And that's what I sense you're kind of talking about.
And I don't know. This could change. I'm 33, so maybe when I'm 40, I'm going to be very fundamental about things.
Well, I mean, or you may have some things that are non-negotiable for you, but you can be in relationship with others who don't go there. I mean, this is part of why I push the conversation in this particular way. We don't often talk openly or go on record for these kinds of things.
Right.
And people will often try to push us up against a wall of being either wishy-washy or being absolute or not having a spine or having too much.
Uh-huh.
I mean, but we need to be nimble.
Yeah.
And to foster that nimbleness.
Uh-huh. I like that term, non-negotiable. Yeah, that's a good one. A good way to describe it.
And it's not forever, but it's for today or for this moment or maybe for this encounter.
Mm-hmm.
But it gives us, you know, a way to move. I want to move on too.
Okay.
What do you do? And this is how we normally kind of close the show in terms of the last few minutes. What do you do on a daily basis, weekly, monthly, yearly, to kind of reset yourself or to clarify what's going on when things kind of begin to come out of control, physically, emotionally, intellectually? What do you do to restore yourself?
I guess the main thing that I do is some kind of sport.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes when if I'm writing something, sometimes the best is to just get away from it, go for a run.
Right.
You start thinking about things and come back and things tend to become more clear or frustrated or I think physical activity. Yeah.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
It tends to be now in this, because of where I am running.
Right.
In the past, it would be maybe surfing.
Uh-huh.
Or it would be a different sport or going for a bike ride or
right
so I guess sport, going for a hike, competitive sports I like, but I don't know if that necessarily gives you the I think it is good, competitive sports. In Argentina I played a lot of soccer.
Uh-huh.
So just going and playing soccer for an hour, you forget basically about everything.
Mm-hmm.
And not thinking about anything else except for this game right now, this moment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not worried about the problems, not worrying about how I'm going to pay for the soccer game afterwards,
right.
What I'm going to do
right.
after. It's like really a good case of living in the moment. And if something happened where maybe I had an argument with my girlfriend the morning before during the soccer game, that all like...
It's all set aside.
Yeah.
Right. And in effect, what you've done is you've kind of induced that meditative state in terms of separating you out, and you're fully immersed in the game.
Right.
And if you're not projecting where you're going to be at the end of the game, then you're still in the moment.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And if you don't, I think you absolutely have to do that to be successful in the game, because if you're thinking about... what you're going to do that night when you're playing soccer, right. They're going to score a goal, or right.
You're going to not be present.
So part of being a good, I guess, competitor is being able to block out everything else that's going on in your life and just focus on the game.
Yeah.
So I think they go hand in hand. Like, in order to be successful while you're playing, you have to do that. So. Mm-hmm.
Do you do anything specifically for emotion to kind of help settle yourself emotionally, or is it bound in the physical activities that you do?
I think mostly physical. To be honest, I don't know if this is a good or bad thing,
sure.
But I consider myself like the opposite of schizophrenic or the opposite of bipolar.
Right.
Whereby I tend to not get too happy or too excited about many things.
Right,
but
right.
At the other end, I tend to not get too like sad or depressed.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes it's kind of boring, right?
Right. And when did you discover that about yourself? How did you discover that? Because that's an incredible kind of observation.
I think it was when something, it was usually like in a moment of, you know, maybe something you looked forward to for mm-hmm. a while, and then you got there and you're like, oh yeah, well, I guess.
Uh-huh.
Or when it was, you know, something really fun going on, and or, you know, it happened and you're like, yeah, that's good. Or something, luckily in my life, I haven't had too many of the, you know, the opposite ones that would bring you to the depression. But I realized, you know, like one time I'm like, you know, I really wish I could just have a little bit of that. You know, I wish I could be like more excited about this,
right?
Or more nervous or happier or something. Like, why am I not?
Right, right. But the image that I have of you is that you continue to be productive and moving, and but you don't need the drama of the extremes, but you don't avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
What was so striking when you described the person who introduced you to cultural stuff, what struck me was the description of the slap.
Uh-huh.
You know, because what I heard was the whole of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that moment I thought, oh, here's a person who learns physically,
mm-hmm.
who really needs to be engaged. And that's what you describe yourself doing for restoring yourself.
Yeah, it's
and
good.
It has a way of filtering emotion.
Well, I don't need to go to a psychoanalyst in Argentina. I can just come on the Native Play Show. This is good. So to answer your question, for the future, can I just come back on the show if I need some emotional?
No. I and you're messing with me, but
no, I'm serious. It's good to.
And
I honestly, when I was in Argentina, I didn't have any specific problem to focus on, but my healthcare paid for psychoanalysts, and I thought about going just for that reason.
Sport in Argentina. I mean, I've met some Argentinians that. I mean, it's like
on Mondays you have music, on Tuesdays you have sports, on Wednesday you talk to your psychoanalyst. Yeah, it's like part of your weekly. So.
Blake, it has been wonderful to
it's
get
been a
to
pleasure.
Know you.
Yeah. Radio handshake.
Yes. And what song would you like to close with?
I'd like to give a shout out to Natalia. She's my fiance now.
Uh-huh.
This song is called La Flaca.
Okay.
It's Flaca. It's really skinny. Sometimes this was like her nickname, but it's basically like how you would do anything for a kiss. The Flaca.
Okay. So. Well, here we go. Thank you.
Igual a la flaca, coral negro de La Habana, tremendísima mulata, 100 libras de piel y hueso, 40 kilos de salsa, y en la cara dos soles que sin palabras hablan, que sin palabras hablan. La flaca duerme de día, dice que así el hambre engaña. Baja a bailar a la tasca y bailar y bailar y tomar una cerveza tras otra, pero ella nunca engorda, pero ella.
sábanas blancas, como dice la canción, recordando las caricias que me brindo el primer día, y enloquezco de ganas de dormir a su ladito, porque Dios, que está flaca, a mí me tiene loquito. Oh, a mí me tiene loquito. Por un beso de la flaca yo daría lo que fuera, por un beso de ella, aunque solo uno fuera. Por un beso de la flaca yo daría lo que fuera, por un beso. Solo.